This is Brian Bowler, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 11th of June 2012. Brian Bowler, Part 2.
What were the muskegs like to look after? You were maintaining them and also trying to improve them, weren't you, Brian?
Well, I didn't know anything about them. I knew they made a few mistakes, like somebody sent me a two-stroke charging set down. Now, the two-stroke in cold weather is a bit of a laugh, but when you want to use it seriously, it's not funny. To tell you how bad it was, this Roxham, I actually got it in the base, warmed it up, started it, and when I walked out into the cold, it stopped. I knew how it felt, but I didn't want it to do that, so I asked for Briggs & Stratton's, which is a reliable engine, please, four-stroke, please, easy to start, and I got them. And I got nearly everything I wanted. The only thing I didn't get right was one tractor had got a positive earth and one had got a negative earth. Now, a negative earth tractor, if you have a generating set, you lean a spanner on it, it tends to dissolve the spanner. And the bright flash puts people off, actually. Yeah. So I think Ron got the shock of his life a few times, because the only way I could do it was the generators had rubber cushy feet. So I put them inside. You remember they had a personnel sack, which was a big bag. I bolted them inside the bag, pulled the bag up, tied the neck, drift proof, lovely. But when you want to run them, roll the bag down, get them started. Bit of a problem there, because they had these auto recoil starts and the balls froze in the auto recoil, so they didn't work. So please, can we go back to a bit of string sort of thing, you know? One was positive earth, one was negative earth. Ron lent a spanner against it, and there was a bright flash, and its spanner disappeared, closely followed by Ron. Ron Gill,
yeah.
The bloke who took over from me as a driver down there. And
were these the first muskegs the Antarctic had used?
No, they'd had them. What's on the Antarctic? They'd had two or three on the British Antarctic crossing.
Oh, yes, 57.
Bonnie Fuchs set up, yeah. 57. And they wasn't 57. Was it only 57? Was it 63 years previously? Oh, no, I thought it'd be early enough. And I gather they performed very well. And Bonnie Fuchs had said he regretted leaving them behind when they were still working, you know. And they carried on with snowcaps. And I think they finished with one muskeg that they gave to New Zealanders. And I said, that fell down a hole, and having crossed the Antarctic, it fell down a crevasse, and I think it killed a couple of them, I'm not sure. But, they were absolutely super. I gather, Bombardier made them, I think somebody said they made over 3,000 of the damn thing. And, they were tough old boots. One of the troubles the first year, they were deck cargo covered in salt, and they were running nicely until one day going up in the afternoon, halfway up the glacier to the airfield, it stopped. So I was on base. I went up there near the muskeg. Couldn't find anything the matter with it. Pushed the button, the damn thing started. You know what is it? And this happened three or four times, and I'm beginning to feel a right steaming bird. I'm the muskeg expert, I know everything about them. Oh, no, I don't. I don't know what's wrong. And so one afternoon, somewhat late-ish, I was on base again. Somebody comes down and says, "One of your muskegs stopped again." I said, "God almighty." I went back up there in the muskeg. And I had someone was there already, so I said, "Look, I'll tell you what, I'll do a check on the plugs and start checking them the normal way, you know, plugs and carburetor and all that sort of go through the series you do." So now this is in the evening, sort of getting a bit duskish, and I've got another bloke with me, starter motor, and the whole of the plug system, the ignition system, lit up. What had happened was it had got salt water on it.
No.
When the tracks were going and throwing snow up, if the wind was in the wrong direction, so it got on the radiator, blew moisture in, and everything shorted out. help, Brian. Well, whilst I'm coming up there, it dries out. What's wrong with it? So anyway, with a liberal application of, you know, WD-40 and clean the plugs up, we never had that problem again. But it made me feel an absolute idiot for a few days, you know. How the hell do you find... I still don't know how I could have found it without someone else, you know.
I've got here your notes about the second season, an extract from your report back to base about muskegs, and you were begging for several improvements, in particular somewhere sheltered in which to work on them.
Well, yeah, people do not realise, where tracks are concerned, the difficulty working on the sides of the tracks. Now, I never had any trouble with tracks, but I wasn't begging, I was only suggesting that they sent a workshop, a covered, because you can work in the cold. You can't work in the snow and you can't work in the wind. So if you can keep the wind and snow off you, you stand a chance. And something inflatable, but with enough room to get at the tracks. That's the important thing, get at the suspension. Because I thought sooner or later they'd have trouble with suspension, which was an absolute sod. Because once you took the side beam off, there was a loud ping and everything went offline. And you had to get it back with turnbuckles and screws and cables and that sort of thing and pull the metal... cross shafts that supported the suspension used to ping out of line. You had to pull them back, you needed cover to do that. So I said, if you're going to, went down at Flossie Buff, they need some form of cover. I wasn't begging, I was only suggesting and saying that, yeah.
Badly needed was a phrase you used.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Did it happen? Did they get their shelters?
Don't know.
Okay. All right. I don't know. You're also asking for a compass.
Yes. Well, as I say, that was in case anybody else wanted to do sea ice and drive at night. As I said, in whiteout, the only way around that is to drive it when you've got visibility. That's at night time with lights. And you need a reliable compass, because the one I had was 27 degrees out. Well, that's a bit much, really, you know. You should wander off into Bellinghausen if you don't, if you're unlucky, you know. And the deviation was unfortunately to the west, which is the general direction of the Bellinghausen. I thought it would be a nice idea. Probably for use in land. I don't know, it might still be useful. But as I say, I had a compass there which did not work. But I mean, if there's an aircraft compass, they're only cheap, and you can adjust them to take up the vehicle magnetism, couple of magnets, 10 minutes or so, you can swing your compass and... you know which way you're going.
You applied quite a bit of plywood casing to them as well. What was the thinking behind that?
Basically, the recirculation. The idea was to recirculate hot air, because, as I say, under certain wind conditions and snow conditions, snow was thrown up, froze on the radiators, and you got the engines overheating. Mm. So, if you covered them in plywood, as I did, and put slides in as well, not only did you stop the drift getting in at night, but you could recirculate warm air and melt the ice on your radiators and still dry and still run on. And the other thing was, I was quite proud of those, because on base when I built them, I got a set of screws and I brazed nuts to the end of the screws. And if you couldn't put it with a speed brace, you know, the sort of handle you use winding nuts with, I went back to square one and removed them so you could actually take it to pieces with your mitts on and using a speed brace. I was quite proud of that. It's a simple thing, didn't I?
One of the bigger modifications was a cable, a winch cable.
Well, they came with winches,
yeah. They came with winches, did they?
Yeah. Some big modifications. Ron Gill, I came up with the idea of building a crane, and Ron Gill fabricated a train out of scaffolding. And that was one of the most useful adjuncts you've ever come across in all your life. I mean, you could pick fuel drums up. When your sledges got cemented in, as they do, you could lift them out as opposed to pull them. Oh, that crane was well worth its weight in proverbial platinum, no mind gold.
Did you build them on both machines?
No, just on one.
Just
no,
the one.
It was getting a bit complicated, I think, on the quiet.
There's a note here about... Ron Gill. I've been asked to ask you why Ron Gill was always sent out on the sea ice first.
I'm not going to tell you, apart from the fact Both John and I weighed about 12 stone. And Ron Gill weighed about 18.
Oh, I see.
So one night he's in the base saying, "I've only just come on base." And both John and Brian, they take my word on checking the ice with an ice chisel. And we were going, "Well, if Ron doesn't fall through, we're going to be all right." But it wasn't all that bad, because when you fall in the sea ice, you don't get wet, you know.
Don't you?
No. Your clothes are so cold that the moment you hit the water, you're a protected barrier of ice. And that lasts for probably half a minute before it melts and you get wet. So you just drag a running, ice-encrusted Ron out, dust him down, send him up in front again. Okay. He wasn't dangerous, but it was, I don't know, just one of the things we did, I suppose.
How did you get on with the four-legged tractors? The Huskies?
I loved them. They're great fun. I was very lucky in that I would be on base when they used to leave them behind, pregnant or nursing or whatever. Yeah. And I used to clip them on my belt and we'd go ski-joring up to the airfield, and three or four dogs at a time. I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was good fun.
And was there some sort of story about a Beaver aircraft as well?
Well, yeah, I'd been flying. The pilots used to let me sit up front and have a cabbie. And he was flying one day, and I think it was Ron Lord, disappeared down the back. And, you know, when you're flying for somebody else, if you like to give the aircraft back when they come back or when they take over again, exactly the same height and exactly the same heading. Mm. So I'm concentrating on flying this Beaver. not all that used to it, but the damn thing was unstable. It wouldn't keep the correct height, and I was juggling everything in the front, and Ron was still down the back. I thought, what the hell's wrong here? Can't be turbulence. Anyway, he comes back. Everything all right? I said, I'll manage it. He said, it was a bit tricky. He said, it is. I'll go and jump it up and down at the back and mess you about. Which was good. But then I remember taking off for one day, jumping downhill at Stonington. And the sun had been on the snow, and I think they were fairly heavily loaded at the time, and it was a flight to Fossil Bluff. So it had been sort of midday, because the light there in the summer's pretty long, as you know. And the ice was giving way under the skis, and we had everything on the instrument panel was in the red, and the only thing that wasn't working properly was the speedometer, and that wasn't going up like it should have been. We virtually fell off the end of the cliff just flying. I can't remember which pilot was turning around. I'm not going to do that again. We're lucky to have the chance, you know. It was just oh Lord, it's a bad habit, isn't it? No, it's just one of these things. You, as I say, second year, third year, you know what you're doing. First year, you haven't got a clue, have you?
Well, there seems to have been very little training in those days for fits.
This is what I'm saying, you know, in that, on the other hand, I don't know, if you give two people too much training, they're going to realise what crap they're going to end up with and say, well, I don't really want to go, you know. You have to be very carefully taught with someone who really understands the personality of 21-year-old graduates.
Okay. Snowy petrels. Did you come across any of those?
What?
Snowy petrels.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love them. I thought they were brilliant. They were down there, middle of winter, almost pitch black, and you'd go out and there'd be a white flash come past. What on earth they eat down there, I have no idea.
This was Stonington, was it?
This was Stonington, yes. And I think there were snowy petrels. And King George Sound, there's a sort of a rock bluff several hundred feet up, and there were snowy petrels nesting up there. So what they eat, I don't know. I've no idea. They must be the most amazing birds.
Was that the only wildlife you saw in the winter?
Yeah, well, obviously penguins weren't there, and seals weren't there. Seals only came up at a certain time to pup. And penguins, we only had a dailies. We were basically junior Hitlers and with bad tempers, if you can imagine that. I've been proposed to by a Pope in the Daily of the Night.
Have you?
Yeah, I was sort of standing there, and it's a daily comes up with a stone at its feet, lays it at my feet, and says, "How's about it, big boy?" Or whatever. And I turned them down, obviously. Emperors used to, only the young ones, go and walk about because we weren't anywhere near their nest. Snowy petrels, and get the skuas, of course. And then in the sea, we got the. We saw orca. I've never seen an enormous pod of these killer whales. You couldn't count them. There must have been 80, 90 of them together. You know, God help anybody that gets in the way of that lot. You know, they really were horrendous. And
did you have any close encounters?
No. No, no. Shot a lot of seal, which is what one did in those days to feed the dogs.
You did a long solo ski trip, Brian, at some point.
Yeah, it wasn't long. It was probably about 10 miles, something like that. No, the diesel mate was complaining about his injector pipes breaking when packing up. And he said there was a bit of a problem. Then somebody said, well, there's a base, an Argentinian base, somewhere away, and they'll have generators on. And I said, I'll pop over. John Cunningham. Yeah, all right, weather's okay. So I chucked a pair of skis on and put a few bits of rations in my pockets. And I didn't take anybody with me because I was so big time, I still am about skiing. There wasn't anybody to keep up with me, you know. I'm used to it. I mean, I'd done 6 weeks every year or 10 weeks every year. And we used to do 25 kilometres a day without breaking into too much of a sweat. So I got there, I found the injector pipes, took them off the generator. I don't know if the Argentinians ever got it running again, I don't know. And I found a record. It was a Los Paraguayos, the whole thing. And so I legged it back to base, or skied back to base. Gave, I don't know, it was Mike Tween, it might have been Mike Tween, I don't know. Diesel at the time, gave him his pipes. And put this record in the base. And I don't know if you know the rule about playing records.
No, go on.
Well, John's theory was you can play as many records as you want as long as it's somebody else's. You may not play your own records.
Right.
Well, this Los Paraguayos came in and they wore the damn thing out. It was on all the time because it was something new.
What was the theory behind that then, that policy of not playing your own records?
Well, I mean, you can imagine what it's like if somebody likes the Beatles and plays the same tune over and over again.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to fall out with it and say, sod off, you know. So it had to be by, somebody else had to ask for it, more or less. I mean, you could go up and listen on your headphones in the bedroom, whatever you wanted, there were no restrictions there. But actually playing loud music, as you can imagine. They're all very sensible rules, you know. All very sensible.
Was it mainly classical music you played, or...?
I didn't play anything at all. I had a few LPs of Mort Sahl and one of Bob Newhart and that sort of thing. And I mean, he was my hero, Bob Newhart. I mean, I've never heard him as brilliant since. You probably know him.
The driving in lesson and
yes, and the submarine.
I don't know that one. I know Walter Raleigh inventing finding tobacco.
Yeah. Hey, you're laughing at it. Yeah. I tell you what, apropos of modern days, and you work for the BBC, how the hell did they get away with Mrs. Brown's Boys? Have you seen it?
Yes, I have, yeah.
How, and it's so funny where she. Some of the things she does, and then you look at it, and it's assisted with a Southern Irish radio programme, and they're on about. Contraceptives. Don't tell me how they did it. I don't know.
How much flying did you do down there then? Could you
not a lot. I went around. Well, I don't really know. It was quite a bit. I mean, I as usual, as you know, as soon as they can get you out for the second year you're going, they get you out. I had a bit of a run in with the Navy at one stage, in that I was on the Biscoe. And they wanted a telerometer or something putting on this island. And we've got a helicopter, and it's going out this island, and they're sort of checking the load off. One telerometer, three batteries, 2 days' food, tent. Whoop! 2 days' food? No way. Oh, well, it's weight restriction. I said, well, there's a weight restriction. I'm going to wait until you get... And I actually had a sort of verbal punch-up with his lordship, with the admiral, whoever it was, and said, we're not going. We're not going on there with limited food. For Christ's sake, I want 6 weeks at least. So anyway, we made them fly the food out first. Because we don't believe you lot, because we'll bring it later. Yeah. And we went on there, and they said that we'll fetch you in 2 days. 2.5 weeks later, they got us out. Admittedly, there wasn't any urgency, because we got food, but if we hadn't had food, they might, you know. No, people just don't realise what can happen. It's just weather like that, you know. Yeah.
There's reference to being an Admiral's taxi service.
Oh, that was the beginning of the end, that was.
This is the Protector, isn't it?
No, he was on the Nabisco at the time.
Go on then, tell me the story.
Well, I don't know, he came on to base, he was at Stonington on base, and it was radio or something, and the Admiral decides he wants to go back. So it's blowing a little bit down any field, and I was new, first year. So, climb in, I'll tell you.
In a beaver?
No, I was in a muskeg.
Oh, right.
So I'm driving the muskeg down Nenny Field, and his lordship says, I say, whatever I'm saying, you drive this rather well. Did you teach yourself to drive it? And there's a sergeant in the army, I turn to the admiral and say, did you teach yourself to be an admiral then? I shouldn't go down very well. Anyway, we got to the boat, and it was engines running up against the sea ice. And I said, fair enough. You're not going back, get on. So we put the cables on, lifted them on board the ship.
The muskeg?
Yeah, put the muskeg on the ship, back on the ship. And pulled away from the ice. And the captain wants to see you. What have I done wrong now? So I went up. Very serious, he said, never do that again. I said, what? He said, look. And I looked out, and there's bits of sea ice coming past with me tracks that I just made on it. All going out.
Is it broke out behind you?
Oh, yes. And in front. It was all over the place. I didn't realise how bad it was. And in fact, he'd been holding the ice in with a boat where we came up to it. So I said, you don't realise what it's like. You know, you don't understand that sort of thing. Anyway, the Admiral got home and dry.
So how did you get back to Stonerton, if you were...
Well, you wait a bit till it the storm blows itself out, and then you chunter up against the ice and dump you on the ice and tell you to bugger off again. And...
Right, with the muskeg.
Yeah. Well,
they saved you. The ship saved you, effectively.
Well, I don't know. Well, yes. Yeah, it did. I got told off for it as well.
Yeah. But were there any other close calls you haven't mentioned yet?
I don't know, really. No, I mean, every day was interesting, if you know what I mean. you could... you didn't realise how tricky life was, you know, and it's not until you hear that, a couple of years after I left, two of the guys died out there. And they were closer than I'd been solo on a ski. So, I mean, I must have been mad. But 20 miles on skis was nothing. You know.
So there's no base commander telling you what to do and what not to do.
No, John was a tough guy. Yeah. I mean, if you thought you could do it, he thought you could do it, he'd let you do it. He made me his deputy at one stage, God bless him, you know, for what it was worth. Well, I don't think anyone else was left, it was just me and the radio up, you know, something like that. But no, I admired the guy, you know, and he let everybody go and do as they wanted. As long as it wasn't crass stupidity, which in my eyes it was really, I suppose, but having said that, he'd probably seen me skiing and skied me ski drawing and knew what I could do. It sounds a bit big headed, doesn't it?
No, not at all, just a question of experience, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Tell me about building this caboose then, where did that idea come from?
Well, basically, a 2-man tent, as you know, is a bit of a job to put up anyway in the bad weather. Mm. And when it's been snowing a bit, it takes a long time to get down. And having taken it down, you've then got the tractor to start, which is basically, you know, you're looking at sometimes up to 2 hours from moving. You look out of the window, and after 2 hours, it's bloody manky again, so you put the tent back up. So I thought, well, if I make a sort of caravan, again, God bless the boat and the builders, there was lots of spare plywood around, I'll build a caboose. And I made it like a brick wall, you know, sort of 8 foot plus a 4 foot bit, and then the other side was 4 foot plus an 8 foot bit, so it's spaced to keep it strong. And I had four bitrues everywhere, and I had a sloping roof and an escape hatch in the roof, gash hole in the floor. And I didn't build it on a sledge, I built it separately from the sledge so that it was attached by bits of rope so the sledge could move without pulling the caboose to bits. And we actually, one day, to give you an idea what how good, if you were lucky, it could be, we looked out, good weather, and Ron and I, and so I think there were three of us in it, two of us went outside, man, and started the tractors. Ron made the coffee or tea, we can, and from getting up to moving the tractors, 20 minutes. Now, that's a hell of an improvement on 2 hours when time is important because the weather's going to change if you're not careful. And well, I thought it was a good idea, you know.
And, so, what were the pros and cons compared to tents? I mean, presumably, was the caboose okay in heavy snow and heavy drifting, or could it get snowed in?
Well, it got snowed. You got a roof, escape hatch, and a roof. And the glory of it was, to a certain extent, was I've got some ring bolts. And I put them on the end of the caboose, so the aerial pole fitted in. You then went out in the snow, you know, sort of 50 to 100 metres, and put another pole in with a couple of guys. Came back in, hanging on the wall, all ready to use the radio. So you could do a radio sked in next to no time at all. Mm. Whereas the other system of using an ice axe and unpacking everything from bags and God knows what would take quite a long time. All right, scientific and people want temperatures and winds and that, but when it takes sort of 3/4 hour out of your trip time, you're very restricted with daylight sometimes as well, or weather. I thought the caboose was a good idea. Sort of recommended it.
Was it cosy?
Oh, very.
What was in it?
It was 12 foot long by about 4 foot wide, I think. And the two, at one end, there were two people slept, and then at the other end, one person slept, and it was opposite him was the cooking stove and all the bits and pieces and the gash hole and the door. So three of you could lie in comfort without being too uncomfortable. It had a window. I had a couple of broken muskeg windows, so I made them double glazed. And I had a funny, I turned canvas inside out and nailed it down so the nails were hidden and all the joints was drift proof. I gather it worked anyway, that was the main thing. I wasn't bothered about what happened after we got to Fossil Bluff.
But you slept in it yourself, did you?
Hmm?
Did you sleep in it yourself?
Oh, yeah. We used it on the trip down. It really was. I'm totally right. Anybody else wants to be stupid, that's the way to do it.
Now, how did it perform in high winds? Because presumably it was rather like a...
Well, it rocked and rolled, but, I mean, it's not a two-man tent. It's got a little thing, the panic rope you hang on to in a high wind. Stop it blowing away. I don't think we had a lot of trouble. You used to get wind scoops and you'd get them frozen in. But, I mean, you get the same with a tent anyway. I think possibly the advantage of a tent, of course, is the weight. You can use it with dogs and ski-doos and that sort of thing, you know. You couldn't tow a caboose around unless you made the whole thing out of polystyrene, then it would blow away.
But you didn't. So, did you not use it on the move? Did you not?
Oh, all the time, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I used to run. I ran a mobile cafe with it down King George Sound. I went out and the guys were dragging a telerometer up and down the nearest mountains, coming back, charging the batteries, having a cup of coffee, and, you know, it was. It was a mobile cafe, really.
But the caboose made the journey from Stonington to Fossil Bluff, did it not?
Yeah.
On the first or second year?
Second journey.
Second year.
Yeah.
And it's still there.
Well, is it?
I presume it's still there. Where else is it
going to
go?
Well, how the hell did it last 50 years? I mean, they did a good building job in it.
Well, it was certainly there in the 60s.
Yeah.
George Kistrup talks about using it as an emergency store and also a reserve shelter in case the hut burnt down.
Oh, yeah, it would make sense. Yeah. Oh, no, you can't expect... I mean, your explorers get used to this tent and, say, the weight problem. But for the tractors, I mean, it weighed virtually nothing.
This is Jonathan Walton writing in the 70s. The caboose was nowhere as near as comfortable as a pyramid tent, but it was convenient not having to pack the sledges every morning. It was entirely weatherproof. And we took the kegs as far south as Coal Nunatak and as far north as Cass Point several times. It was used frequently for trips to and from Sporton Glacier.
Yeah.
In 1973, Aphrodite broke through ice covering a melting pool and submerged.
Yeah.
The rear tow bar was about 2 foot underwater. With assistance of the winch on Blodwyn and some ice-filled scaffolding poles and some ingenious pulley systems,
yeah,
Jim Bishop and Roger Tindley extracted Aphrodite, put her on a moored home,
yeah,
and took her back to the bluff.
Yeah. Well, I'd say a rebuild of that would be reasonable, but I would say, because it's so basic, providing they can fly the stuff in, it's fairly simple engineering. There's nothing over clever about a muskeg. It's basic agricultural tractor with no problems, and the gearbox and steering guy I had no problem with. I thought they might have it later on. But I don't know, and quite honest, I'd be surprised if they had much problems. Might have been a bit of condensation problems, because you do get that, but don't talk about that.
Jonathan Walton suggests that by the mid-70s, the skidoos were beginning to take over.
Well, mid-70s, that's 15 years. It's not bad. No, of course, the skidoo's going to be much, much better because it's much lighter. Mm. And when you're flogging round up on the glacier, they're not going to fall through quite as many crevasses, are they? But I say, for actually running up and down the Sound and doing a... been a transport cappy for the surveyors who were going up and down putting tree points in. It did the job.
What do you remember then? So when you arrived at Fossil Bluff the first time, were they still in the process of setting it up at that point? Or was Fossil...
No. It was already built. They'd spent the year there, or the winter there. And I think it took us 90 days, and the aircraft had been down there about 3 or 4 weeks earlier.
Right.
The second trip only took about 23 days, and the aircraft only beat us by 3 days.
But on that first trip, what were you taking things down, supplies down to Fossil Bluff?
No, we were just taking the tractors down and fuel and that sort of thing, and I thought I'd take as much fuel as I could, do 2 or 3 trips from base and relay the stuff down to get as much fuel down there as possible. I mean, a couple of drums of fuel, the poor beaver's looking a bit sort of... it's quite a weight, you know. Mm. But I wasn't... We didn't have any instructions of what to do or how to do it. Just take these two down to Fossil Bluff, you know.
So would you say Fossil Bluff was complete by the time you arrived as a base?
Oh, yes, yeah. Generator had broken down.
Did you fix it?
No, I think they flew another one in. I was sort of, and somebody brought some soap because they'd run out of soap about a month previously. one of the radio operators came down and very politely said, "It's not very tidy, Fossil Bluff. It's a little bit dirty. Would you mind if I washed it?" And somebody said, "Well, if you've got any soap, we'd rather have a wash first." Sort of thing. It was a bit basic. The food was a bit horrible. There was a bit of a cock-up, I'm labelling or something, and they got sort of 4,000 tins of freeze-dried beans and not a lot of anything else. I don't know, somebody's mentioned that, I should think. So, again, the neighbour, this admiral guy came down and said, furthest sailor since Scott. And I said, well, I'm a soldier. I've just come back from down south. Couldn't resist the Navy. Anyway, I said, what would you like? He said, can we have some meat? Well, I'm flying back the ship. I'll get you some sent down. And the Bisco, God bless him, sent down a large lump of mutton, which we couldn't eat.
Because?
We'd lost the muscles and the jaws. We'd been living on sledging rations and dried foods and tin foods for 6 months. Nothing to chew. And our jaws weren't strong enough. God. We just lost the strength. I mean, there are some funny things happen and you don't realise.
Yeah. According to Bass Records, there's still one muskeg in the garage at Fossil Bluff today.
Well, they'll probably make it in a World Heritage Site. Why not? No, I'm pleased. I mean, I know I didn't appreciate really what we were doing because I didn't understand it. It was just a delivery job.
Do you appreciate it now? Do you realise how important that was?
To a certain extent, yes. But so what? It was just a job. No, I was in the forces. I finished that job. I went back to the army, obviously. Mm. And I got flown straight out to Singapore, which is a bit of a change from Possibler. Mm-hmm. And Singapore said, we want you. You're going to Kuching, which is in Borneo. So I said, all right. So I got on a plane to Borneo. I was met with a boss at the airport. Oh, now then, Sergeant, got a job for you. Don't unpack. I was in UK 1.5 days earlier, you know. Don't unpack, you're going up country. You've got a troop. Your troop leader. You've got a troop up at the sharp end there. Somebody's just stood up in Parliament and said there are no Australians in Borneo. Well, unfortunately, they hadn't counted the captain, the sergeant, and this unit you're going to take over. And I get the hell up there quick. Said, what do I do? Said, well, just liaise with the Gurkhas, see what they want. And every time anybody blinks, they should see an armoured car. And that was my job. And I was 003, I think it was, south, on the equator. And instead of snow, it rained 300 inches a year. Mm. Second wettest place in the world, you know. So, it's a job. It's your life, it's your work. You don't bother too much. I mean, I've been in... with armoured cars. I've been in crashes. I've been upside down in armoured cars. I've actually landed my own glider in a hedge, which is a bit of a cock-up. I'm used to sort of with things going wrong, but never permanently. I've never considered that all these things are going to be permanent. Mm. The Bellinghausen nearly got me, but I didn't appreciate it at the time. Yeah.
So looking back over your long, long career in the Army and subsequently, how do those 2 years in the Antarctic rate?
Oh, they ruined me completely.
They ruined you?
Oh, yeah.
Why
yeah.
is that? How
well, I'd survived, hadn't I? You get that feeling that, I don't know what the base guys are like, but when you get out in the field and you have a rough old time of it, which we certainly did, you're not king of the pile. You're not the best guy in the world or anything like that. But you're not bothered about the ones that are. You know, I've done what I need to do. I've spent a considerable amount of time staying alive, working at it hard. Mm. And in the army, people spend a lot of money trying to kill me, and they failed as well. So you feel pretty bulletproof, you know. I mean, even now, I've had the odd heart attack and that sort of thing. I'm not particularly worried about it. You know, I'm going to snuff it sooner or later. But like Woody Allen, I just don't want to be there when it happens.
So that suggests it built up confidence and self-resistance, self-reliance.
Yeah, but the trouble there was you've got this attitude of, well, nothing outside worries you all that much because you'll always survive, you'll always be able to do something. I suppose it was a sense of achievement, but you didn't feel like that. It felt that, yeah, so what? Tick, done it. You know, which is a good fit saying, yeah, tick, done it. What next? Mm.
Were the things you learnt in the Antarctic that were useful later in your life or career?
No, got me into trouble. Would you believe it? The army sent me on a winter warfare course, and we're out in the Mire Dam, you know, out in the sort of Forestdale.
Whereabouts?
It was in Germany. And it's midwinter. And one of the instructors there was a very clever bloke, and he wasn't properly dressed. He was wearing Langlauf boots, which were not properly done. So in the morning, we'd all built our tents and shelters and that sort of thing. His Majesty's got frostbite. So, right, you're the senior bloke here. Organise a party to get him on a sledge and get him out. He said, sod him, he can walk. What? He said, I'm not pulling him. It's self-inflicted, he can walk. It'll hurt. I'm not bothered. I'm not pulling this stupid sod. I told him. He knows all about it. If he doesn't listen, that's his fault. But he's an instructor. So what? Now he knows you'll be an even better instructor when he gets his foot back. And I was like that. I just didn't give a damn. I mean, I knew what I was on about, and I wasn't going to get frostbite.
Did you fall out with anybody whilst you were in the Antarctic or whilst you were working with Bass?
Not as far as I can. People say, if anybody says they fell out with me, I don't believe it. Ron was a little bit difficult to get on with to start with, because he had no idea what was up. He'd just come from Malaya or somewhere and was used to high temperatures. And he had several sort of oh-nasties with batteries and things because he didn't realise. My batteries are very high-specific gravity. And of course, I only kept them for a year. I mean, Ron actually had frozen batteries that cracked and broke. And that was because some clever bloke sent electrolyte down in carboys. And the labels were in paper. And when the carboys filled, it burnt all labels off. Mm-hmm. And there were two different strengths. And so the batteries got filled up at the wrong strength. They put them out in the tractors and they froze and cracked. So I think I used a bit of strong language where that was concerned. And, you know, you better get it right now because you ain't going to get a second chance, you know. But I think that was about the only time I didn't fall out with anybody, I don't think. I may have thought I fell out with them, but I don't think I did. I don't think I did. It was difficult. I say you were up against a load of undergraduates, or graduates rather, that all knew it all. Well, I thought they did. Until they tried to play chess against John Cunningham.
He was good, was he?
Well, he'd play three or four of them at a time and beat the arse off them. You know, he was good, yeah. And he was a shipwright from Glasgow. Tough guy. More brains than the average set up, you would see, and he really was. And what he'd done, his experience in climbing and that. And he was the original. His stories about climbing in the Himalayas and that sort of thing were hilarious, you know, the things they got up to. All illegal. And
the real reason you and everybody else was down there was nothing to do with science or exploration. It was all to do with politics, wasn't it? Being there.
Yeah, I don't think it's... Well, they did find the ozone hole, the hole in the ozone layer,
later, yeah.
And they made millions of quid and got a big organisation out of that. And it's the most fortuitous discovery ever known to anybody in Cambridge. No, I didn't.
But in your period, it was a case of flying the British flag.
No, we didn't have a flag.
Metaphorically, then?
No.
No?
No. Well, it may have been to management, but it wasn't to us. What they said was they wanted to do an aerial survey because there were no maps. The map I saw was King George Sound, continuous mountains in this area. Right. So someone back had an idea, well, we'll do a survey. To do a survey, we've got to put trig points down on the top of these mountains. There's a load of enthusiastic mountaineers and me climbing up these mountains, first ascent. I mean, what would a climber get for first ascent? I mean, I used to do it every day with a battery on my back, you know. And, no, it was just a job, you know. We were nowhere near the Argentinians. We didn't meet any Argentinians. They came across the base whilst I was away. Certainly Chileans we didn't meet. We didn't meet anybody other than us. We were a very sort of select little bunch way out on an island there waiting for the rest of the world to blow itself to pieces, as I said earlier on.
Were you genuinely concerned about the Cuban Missile Crisis? Or was it tongue-in-cheek? I mean, presumably you were hearing about it on the World Service, were you?
Well, you couldn't be really worried about it all that much when it was 13,000 miles away. Mm. I mean, we wouldn't have heard the bang. But there was always that possibility, you know. And I don't know how you felt about it, but I should think everybody around there... I think Andrex sold an awful lot of paper, you know.
I was nine. I do remember Richard Dumbleby telling me on the television... No, the radio, I think it was, that when it was all over, that it was safe to go to school the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, kids didn't have that, but so we... Have you heard the story about radio Peking?
Go on.
Tell me. Radio communications down there were tricky, you know, and you want to listen to something. And we were, this is Howard Chapman, and we were going round and the only radio we could get station was Radio Peking. And we only just got it, and it was halfway through a programme.
In English?
In English, yes. Radio Peking. And the announcer said, if you answer three questions correctly, you'll get a picture of Chairman Mao and a copy of Chairman Mao's thoughts and a two-week visa for something in Shanghai. If you get it wrong, you'll get two copies of... So we listened to this, and the programme finished. And question one, what is the standard diet of honourable Chinese people? A big argument, because some of these clever geologists, blokes got a degree in geography, said, millet! No, got to be rice. So we put down rice. What utensils do the Chinese use to eat this food with? So, well, they don't use a spoon or the fingers. No, chopsticks. Chopsticks. Third question, what world record is held by a Chinese lady athlete? Oh, shit. We hadn't heard the programme. So we send the cable to Stonington saying, will you please send this to Radio Peking? Question one, rice. Question two, chopsticks. Question three, and Howard had thought something up. And we got something back from Stanley saying, are you sure you want to send this? Yes. Question one, rice. Question two, chopsticks. Question three, 5,000 metres, ladies open freestyle rickshaw. We never got a copy of Chairman Mao's thought. Apart from, if you've got a spare rocket, base he should get it, you know.
Shall we call it a day?
Yeah, I've been... I'm sorry, I talk too much. I'm a bit verbose.
You're supposed to talk. Yeah. Is there anything I've missed? Anything critical I've missed?
No, not really. Not really. I don't know if anybody talked about the day I nearly fell off a mountain, but there we are.
Go on, where was that?
I don't know. Someone named Lump on the other side of the sound. And like John had said, we won't rope together, there's no need for it. Don't have your ice axe tied to you because you break your wrist. And we're climbing up the side of this bloody mountain or whatever, and the ice steps broke, gave way, and I slid down a slope towards a big hole. And I hadn't got my ice axe. That was sliding down. And I've spread myself out on the ice. I had crampons on. I spread myself out on the ice to slow myself down because the ice axe was travelling very slightly faster than I was. And I managed to slow myself down enough until this ice axe met me. I'm still sliding down this slope towards God knows what. And I got this ice axe. And I always remember some dying day how I got both arms around it and dug it in. And went, whew, that was close. And got back up on the slope and, you know, carried on. Did it all over again, but, you know. No, you didn't worry over
you
much.
You didn't have a sleepless night?
No. Mm-hmm. Quite a pity, you did get big eye, of course, as you probably know, you hear people doing it, yeah. But it's daylight all the time, and people can't sleep. Or on the base during the winter, everybody stops up till 3 o'clock, doesn't get up till the smoker at lunchtime, you know, whatever it was. Did you hear about the rice cakes?
The?
Rice cakes.
Rice cakes, no.
Mm. Again, somebody will be nameless as a scientist. And it was his turn to be cooked, as we know, we did turn and turn about for a week. And he said, I can't do cakes. John said, of course you can. He said, I can't do cakes. You're a scientist. Follow the recipe. He said, all right. So anyway, we came in smoking some beautiful cakes. A little drop of jam on top there. Little scone things. Absolutely gorgeous. Bloody hell! What have you done? He said, I followed the recipe. Well, you can't do it. He suggested, mind you, we didn't have any ground rice, so I used ordinary rice. That's true. I don't know. I've enjoyed talking.
It's been an adventure. Thank you very much. Thank you.